Hello there, and you're very welcome to Burning Books. Joining me today is acclaimed poet Anne-Marie Ní Chuaron. Her latest collection, Hymn to All the Restless Girls, is published with Gallery Press. Anne-Marie, I have a picture of you as a little girl. From listening to your interviews and reading your poetry over the years, and I wonder, is it the right image of you as a sort of a little fairy type, inquisitive, interested in the magical realm? Maybe that's not true at all. What were you like as a little girl? And what kind of books were you drawn to?
I think I was, like a lot of children, very imaginative, naturally imaginative. I grew up in northwest Donegal. It was a very rural setting. I grew up surrounded by boglands and the Seven Sisters, the mountains that still feature so prominently in my life, really. I'm often thinking about them in my writing. But I suppose I was the oldest child in the family, which meant I often spent long spells of time on my own. I was blessed, you know, with a kind of a badass grandmother, Donegal grandmother, who was a fantastic storyteller. She lived right next door. She was full of folklore and superstitions and potions and legends and tales. And, you know, we'd sit together on our two-seater couch for hours. And I was our first grandchild. So she had all the, you know, will and time in the world to indulge me. And she really gave me such a love of stories right from the get-go. But I was also very lucky in that I had a very adventurous, brilliant imaginary friend. And he was an international traveler. And he was also, he was quite naughty in that he'd get into wrestling wild animals and was always involved in different kind of car chases, and would often go missing as well, which kept me on my toes. And when he came back to the house and, you know, a place was set at the dinner table, he had fantastic stories. So he was a big part of my storytelling kind of life as well.
And Marie, what was his name and what age were you when you had your imaginary
friend? I'm not going to tell you his name because it's too silly. It's too silly and embarrassing. But he's well known in the family. He's a bit of a legend. You know, he lives on.
That's really interesting. Does he still, like, is he still your imaginary friend?
I'm not sure. At some point, I'm not sure at what point he kind of took off for good. I don't remember missing him per se, because he'd often be away and send postcards as well. Postcards would come to the house, or, you know, phone calls would come to the house. we naturally parted ways. But it's funny, I hadn't thought about him, Ruth, in years until I started to think about this podcast and the adventures that I had as a child. And I realized, wow, he was just so prominent, right? You know, across a few years, really.
Can I ask you, is there anything, because I know you're somewhat of an expert on this, I don't know, but is there anything in Irish myth and legend about an imaginary friend, as a child having an imaginary friend? I wonder.
I'm sure there must be. You know, I mean, like in general, in Irish stories, that line between this world and the other world is always very thin, and people are wandering through the veil, you know, from one side to another. So,
but you consciously uncoupled from him anyway at around whatever age.
I consciously uncoupled, from him probably at about, God, it was, you know, probably about five, I would say. But maybe by the time I went to school, you know, I went to school early, so maybe about four or five. So we had a good few years hanging out together.
We'll see if we can get his name out of you before the end of the thing. So you went to school about, so sort of the normal age to go to school, about 5 years old. You went to
school. You know what?
School.
I I went to school. My memories of going to school are very hazy because I actually went to school when I was three. It was a small school and they were under pressure to kind of retain their teachers. This often happens in rural Ireland. And they were kind of going around the houses looking to see were there any kids that were just a year off school age, you know, that might attend. So it was far too young, Ruth.
And of course.
It was very hazy and it was a little bit traumatic, you know, to have to be brought to a school and left alone for a full day at that age. And I can't remember, was the imaginary friend with me or not? But sometime in those years, you know, he went his own way
off to find himself. Okay, that is quite a difficult start to school, being so young, being three, and those kind of hazy memories. So you stayed there, right? You were there from three, so you had an extra 2 years in primary school or something like that. Then did you leave primary school at a very young age also?
No, I also left primary school relatively young. And then I later did transition year in secondary school, which made up for some of the time. And I have kind of mixed, you know, feelings about national school. It was quite a difficult time for, you know, young kids in school. And at the same time, I remember developing this love of handwriting. And we had teachers who were very keen on writing personal essays. And we had one teacher in particular who took time every day to share folklore with us, very big on geography, histories of place, and the legends and myths attached to different places as well. So it was, in its own way, a very rich schooling as well, and a really great start for, you know, somebody who would become interested in writing.
So it was your grandmother and then this sort of first introduction to folklore at primary school then that kind of was your first, in quotation marks, reading. Were you reading yourself at that point? Or can you remember the first book that you read alone? You know, that very special thing when you were alone with the book as a child. Do you remember what that was?
Yes, I do remember climbing up into the attic at a young age, like at an age where I shouldn't have been going up a ladder. And I remember finding a box up there in the rafters, and I pulled out this book that I have to this day on my desk, The Poems of Dr. Zhivago, translated from the Russian by Eugene Cadden. And it has these drawings and illustrations by Bill Greer. You know, it's a slim kind of hymnal type book. And I opened the pages, you know, The Poems of Dr. Zhivago by Boris Pasternak. And I was absolutely just overawed by the shape of poetry on the page. You know, I was still quite young in my reading life. I'd only by that point read maybe Enid Blyton books, and there was a copy of Treasure Island. And to be kind of honest, the books were thin on the ground because there wasn't a local bookshop, there wasn't a local library, and you know, there was a hunger there to discover books. And when I found this amazing book in the attic, I discovered it had been a wedding gift or an engagement gift to my parents. And I often go back to this poem in the book. It's a really short poem, Intoxication. Can you imagine discovering this as a child? 'Neath a willow with ivy entangled, we take cover in blustery weather. My arms are wreathed about you, in my rain cape we huddle together. I was wrong, not ivy, my dearest, but hops encircle this willow. Well then, let's spread in its shelter my cape for a rug and a pillow. I was completely romanced by the book, and I immediately wrote my name. I can still see my child's handwriting on the inside cover, and that book became talismanic. And that was almost the very first time that I'd seen a poem in a book. And I didn't know, I couldn't articulate at that time, you know, why I loved it, but it was something about the rhyme, it was the shape it made on the page, It was the beautiful illustrations, the romance of it,
yeah,
and this color and texture and the feeling. The book like had this feeling of being like a cape that wrapped around you. You know, it was an amazing find.
That's so beautiful. And I suppose there's that kind of mystery in the words at that age. You don't really understand maybe half of their meanings, but you're just getting that gorgeous kind of immersion in it. I really like that you put, it's interesting how often, and as children, we put our names on the books. I don't know when we stopped doing that. Well, I stopped doing that. But you put your name on it. That's interesting, isn't it? It's like you mark it.
Yeah, really. I've often thought about that myself. And I thought, you know, I can't think of anything that I've taken from my parents' house without permission. But something in me was like, this is my book. Mm. This is my book now. And it was never really questioned. I took it down from the attic. It was probably the only poetry book that they had. And it's been with me my whole life. And isn't it incredible that, like, the nose we have for finding books?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it was not a bookish household. Like, when I think of the 1980s in that townland, without access to a library or a bookshop, neighbours passed around black bags of books to each other, and they'd contain things like Danielle Steele, you know, or what do you call the author of Flowers in the Attic?
Oh, yes, Flowers in the Attic, and the other one, yes, the
series.
Yeah,
that whole series. You know, it was that kind of stuff. And like, you were definitely hungry for these books, but what a gem to find in the middle of all that. You know, we kind of get the scent of poetry sometimes, I feel, and you can be drawn towards like a moth to a flame.
Yeah, I really like that though, a nose, that you have the nose for a book, because it's so true, isn't it? You kind of like sort of sniff out these books when you're younger, and there's no real kind of if you were a believer in that kind of thing, you would say it was the, you know, universe directing you towards what you were meant to find.
Yeah, and we've all had that experience of going into a bookshop and there's thousands of books, but somehow you find yourself at the right book. Mm. And you know, this is the book for me. So I don't know, there's something intuitive about the way that we move towards individual books as well.
Well, I mean, it's just fitting that you would have this most poetic of stories of finding this book of poetry as a child. That's gorgeous. And I love that you still have it and that you can hold it and touch it. And there's that kind of physical connection. Mm. It's gorgeous. So that was the first, and it is incredible, that was a poetry book out of all the other, out of what wasn't available to you, that you find this poetry book. Did that start you off looking for more? Like, you know, did that give you a taste for it, or kind of like, oh, did you want to go looking for more? Or what happened to you as you kind of went through primary school and then moved on with your reading?
Well, I think there was a long period of continuing to read then what was available to me, and aunts and uncles would give books as gifts, and there were some books limited available through national school. But the wonderful thing about not having a lot of, you know, books available to me was I became a curious, hungry reader, and I would read things that, you know, were in a way they kind of were not the books that you'd expect an 11 or, you know, a 10 or 11 year old to be reading. Like, for example, my godmother, who I was really close to, had this incredible book that she gave to me. And I don't know if you remember this. It was like a Bible. It was called Frankly Feminine, and it was published in 1965. It was published or edited by a woman called Eileen McCarthy, and it was a kind of finishing school Bible. And it was just extraordinary. You know, it was kind of billed as advice for the woman of today. And it had all of these sections. You know, they're bizarre now when we look back. How to make a pretty speech, how to eat difficult food, how to put on a brassiere. You know, you step it, you step into it. You there was simple carpentry, your husband, money, imagination, and marriage. And I remember, you know, discovering that book, which she gave to me. And even, you know, I knew at a very young age, this is old-fashioned, outdated, misogynistic, you know, really problematic advice. But it was the only window that I had into what it might be to be a woman in the world. And I used to leaf through that, you know, how to make a cocktail for your husband at the end of the day. But again, when I look back, that taught me a lot about the world that I was about to enter. And when I think of my writing now today, which often explores women's lives, misogyny, sexism, power dynamics, you know, that book, Frankly Feminine, is at the back of my imagination, because as problematic as it was and difficult, and I'm quite sure nobody's reading it today, it gave me information. You know, it gave me real information that even in the 1980s, it was still somewhat useful to know, you know, as you're coming of age. But that was like a big white Bible with gold, you know, on the top of it. So that was what I was making do with, you know, until I did transition year, and then I got my library card. And I remember getting the bus to Letterkenny, the Lochs Willie. And, you know, it's like a 40-minute journey. It probably took an hour and a half on one of these buses to get out to Letterkenny. And to have my library card. And then I could start, you know, discovering the bookshelves out there. And I discovered, oh, wow, short stories, essays, novels.
Wow.
You know, like the world began to completely open up. And then this magical thing happened when I was around 15, 16. I was in the school hallways, and I bumped into a visiting gentleman, Jimmy Simmons, who turned out to be a poet who had moved to Falkara. Mm-hmm. And he said, hey, somebody told me that you are interested in poetry, because I'd become kind of interested through the school syllabus. And he said, would you like to come to the Poet's House? We're newly based up in Falkara, and we're running an MA in creative writing, or was it poetry? Sorry, an MA in poetry, I think, or I'm not sure, it could be creative writing. And he said, we have a workshop on Saturday. Would you like to come to a poetry workshop? And I had no idea, Ruth, what I was agreeing to, but I said yes, very enthusiastically. Of course, like, how often does a new poetry school arrive to Falkara? And I went up on that Saturday, didn't know what to expect. Workshop, I just thought, was something like a tool shed, you know, where lots of, you know, broken and kind of things got repaired, which was not, turned out not to be too far from the truth. And there was a lady there with a glass of whiskey, and she was gathered with a group of poets around the table, and it was Leland Bartwell.
Oh my goodness.
And she was giving a poetry workshop, and she said, come in, come in. And of course I was the youngest there, and I just had the most glorious afternoon discovering you know, how a poem gets made. And that almost changed, you know, That was such a fortuitous event, and it changed my whole idea of what was possible for the future. And through the Poet's House, I became a really eager and keen reader of poetry. You know, I was introduced there to Sylvia Plath's Ariel. I remember opening the pages with Lady Lazarus, and it was just electric. I mean, I'd gone from reading Frankly Feminine to suddenly reading, you know, Sylvia Plath, Dying is an Art, like everything else, I do it exceptionally well, you know, and just reading the sparseness and those lines that are full of raw energy and bristling, you know, it's like the nerve endings of the words are just so alive. I thought, wow, you know, there's a whole world now of poetry for me to discover. So I discovered gallery press books at the Poet's House. I discovered American poets, poetry in translation. Of course, they all knew of Dr. Zhivago. And it was like joining then a tribe, you know, and they knew about books and were able to guide me. Now, a lovely thing is that it was also this was pre having, you know, internet access in the home. So, you know, somebody would photocopy a poem from a book for you, or they would lend you a book, or you have to write down the name of a book and go to Letterkenny and order it and wait for it to come in. It might be 3 weeks, 6 weeks before it came into the bookshop in Letterkenny Courtyard. So yeah, it was all just a joyous kind of time, really.
But that gives you that spaciousness, you know, without the internet, that spaciousness and solitude and time to absorb and like talk to your peers or your, you know, your mentors at the time. Like it would be very different maybe if the internet had been there. It sounds so special.
Yeah, and you had to have conversations with people about the books that you wanted, or they would have conversations with you about why they were going to recommend this book to you. Like now you order the book online and it's kind of a solitary thing, and the book comes to you and you're not having a conversation with the person who delivers it. It's just, you know, dropped at your door, comes through the letterbox. But my memory is that people didn't have easy access to these books. So they were passed around and there was a kind of a sacredness and there was a community and there was a conversation about the books.
I love that. That's such a beautiful apprenticeship. My goodness. And so you took that with you, obviously, or continued that on. You went on to university, Anne-Marie, did you?
Yeah, I did communications at DCU. It was a BA 3 years. And I often describe coming to Dublin and trying to find my way around and feeling like I was a goat in a supermarket. Like I was so out of place. I just couldn't figure. I was 3 years of being bewildered and I'm just completely puzzled by everything. And, you know, I couldn't figure out how to get in and out of town. I kept getting schedules wrong. I was one of those kids who kind of drifted through university feeling really lost and you know, like that Irish language word uaighneas, you know, encapsulates so richly the experience of feeling lonely for somewhere and you don't know where that place is. Because I wanted to leave Donegal and begin my book life and begin my reading life and my academic life. I was hungry to get out of rural Ireland, but I also had this deep ache and I used to cry the whole way from Donegal to Dublin, and I just didn't feel like I was at home in the city, you know. So it was kind of a shaky start to my new life in Dublin, but books during that time were my friend, of course, and during that time I came across Edna O'Brien's Country Girls, you know, like many, many other teenage girls. You know, this book came into my life and, you know, Baba has been camping out in my imagination since. And I realized, wow, I'm not alone. You know, this is a real experience that young women coming from rural Ireland have. And I was just so, I suppose I was so taken by Kate and Baba's relationship. And I'm still really interested in the relationship between women and in sisterhood and in the pressure that patriarchy puts on female relationships. Mm. It's something I'm still thinking about today. And I myself come from a family where there were a lot of sisters, because I had my biological family, but I also had tens of foster sisters. So this book, Country Girls, you know, arrives into my sphere at some point, and I think, oh wow, I'm not alone, you know, in trying to figure my way out in the city and navigate female relationships and have dreams and try to, you know, figure out what the possibilities might be for realizing those dreams.
Yeah, because you talk a lot about your sister poets in your interviews and various things, that you have a real strong connection to. Is it Kimberly Campanello and who's your other sister poet?
And Demetra Exidus.
Demetra, yeah. So that's hugely important to you.
Very important. Like when I think of the place of books in my life, I also think of the authors and the poets, and especially the female community, you know, and how it's always been a very supportive place for me. And I'm always excited about how, you know, we might tell and retell or reimagine the stories of women's lives. And maybe it does go back to my grandmother, Mary Haig, you know, and I have this connect, I have made this connection, I suppose, or there's a kinship between books and female community in my life. Yeah.
And there's a very, to me anyway, it's such an intimate connection to the girls that you write about in your poetry. You inhabit them, really. You know, it goes beyond sort of empathy to something else. It's great. And I liked as well when you talk about how, you know, a lot of people talk about their poetry as evolving, or there's some kind of line of it evolving and changing and maturing or whatever. But I love the way you talked about it. Like there's a sort of a, like retrospective deepening, you know, from your latest volume to your first volume, and like a kind of, I love that a little bit, like your grandmother, you know, there's this kind of, it's not necessarily the past is in you, you're talking back to it, it's all kind of, and as you keep writing, it keeps on sort of re-flowering. I really like that way of looking at it. I just find it really, I find the whole matrilineal thing really interesting, the line to your grandmother, and to these girls that, of course, you never knew, and yet it feels like you do, it feels like you have a, you know, a relationship. If that doesn't sound too trite.
Yeah, I suppose I am often thinking about how coming from Donegal and also growing up in the Irish language and having a close relationship with my grandmother, Mary Haig, how that has orientated me, you know, in lots of ways. And the poet Joy Harjo says of poetry that, you know, when we're writing poetry, we have the power to change the past. And I really feel that to be true, that you're changing your perspective on the past all the time. You're bringing it in and out of focus. You're gaining some kind of control over it, or at least you're surrendering yourself to the fact that sometimes you have no control over it. But when you're writing poetry, you're in a kind of dream space where you're moving between different time zones. You're back and forth into the past. You're imagining the future. And even more than that, when I feel, you know, when I'm writing poetry, I'm engaging with a sense of orientation that is beyond, like, even just north, west, south, and east. That there's, you know, there's what is underneath you, above you, inside you, outside you, what comes through you. You know, there's all of these different portals of time and reality, I suppose, that I'm really interested in. And time is a cyclical thing. And I just totally, you know, I'm resisting this idea of linear time, and that one book after another, and everyone has to be kind of maybe distinctly different or doing something new. Like, as you said, that endeavor of trying to flower something and get deeper into it and get down into the roots and explore all the different dimensions of, you know, a subject, that's much more interesting to me. Yeah.
Absolutely. And Marie, is there a book that you associate maybe with something else that happened to you in your life, not necessarily at college or at primary school, but is there a book perhaps that you have on your desk now, do you think, that is, I don't know, that was along with you? Maybe it was a difficult point, maybe it was a beautiful point in your life, but a book that maybe just, that stands out for you.
In 2014, my foster brother, Darry, died suddenly in a car accident. And that was very shocking, unexpected event that I found really complex to navigate, because he was my foster brother and for a very long time, but he was not living with the family when he had the accident. And, you know, every grief has its own kind of complications, but I found that really tough to get through. And think it was my partner, Niamh, who gave me a book during that time. It's titled Gabriel, a Poem by a man called Edward Hirsch. It's a poetry book, and it's a book-length poem in tercets without any punctuation. And it's an elegy by Edward Hirsch for his adopted son, who also died suddenly. And it's an extraordinary book. Like, I just never even could have imagined a book of its weight. And it was such a lifeline for me, you know, to open this book and to realize that you can take a really complex, tangled, knotted story, you know, the kind of story that you almost don't know where to start, and you can, you know, put it into a form like this terse, it's just one long lament, and that you can let this kind of tangled story be tangled in a book. You know, it was a revelation to me that there might be a way to write my own personal experience of grief in this way. I'll just read you a few lines from the opening of that book. It's called Gabriel. It was published by Knopf in 2014. And the first few lines goes follows. The funeral director opened the coffin, and there he was alone, from the waist up. I peered down into his face, and for a moment I was taken aback, because it was not Gabriel. It was just some poor kid whose face looked like a room that had been vacated. But then I looked more intently at his heavy eyelids and fine features. He had always been a restive sleeper. Now he was weirdly still, my reckless boy. I have read that book, I would say, at least 50 times, you know. It reminds me that no matter how difficult the experience and how tangled the narrative, and no matter how much it feels like the story is in shards and fragments, that there is always a way in which poetry can hold it, you know. Mm-hmm. So, for anyone going through, I suppose, a complex bereavement,
yeah.
I always recommend that book. And of course, I always recommend the Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion. But they're my go-tos for processing loss.
Mm. And those shards, though, that pain and that complexity, I know that you bring that into your work, albeit in a different landscape or sublimated. But do you find that I don't want to say it's purging, but do you find that offers you some kind of, I don't know, valve or I'm not sure what word it is that I'm searching for, but I think you know what I mean. Do you find that it gives it a place to go?
I do, and it gives me hope to think that painful experience can be transformed, and it makes me feel like there's something useful I can do. And every life has its pains and aches, and people go through extraordinary difficult kind of stories that are like uniquely painful. But I think that, you know, this sense that there's always a place to bring it, the page is always going to listen. And with enough work and time, you know, true language, it can be transformed. Like, I can't imagine my life without that. I rely on it heavily, and I also find it very freeing. It can be an inherently joyous process to know that when everything else is taken away from you, you've still got your voice, you've still got your language, and you've still got your imagination. And, you know, when I think of Donegal culture as well, it's often called the left behind county. It's right up there on the northwest border with Northern Ireland. It's suffered a lot from socioeconomic disadvantage, long patterns of immigration, people having to leave an aging population, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what I learned growing up in that environment is that your imagination counts for a lot. And when everything else has been taken from you, you still have language, you still have roots, tradition, and your voice. And once you have those things, I really truly believe that, you know, you're well equipped to navigate your way through difficult emotional experience.
Now, I wanted to ask you about a book that, and this is actually harder, I think, for most people to answer, because it's actually, and I find it, when I think about it, it's very hard to answer, but a book that you go back to perhaps that makes you laugh, and if not actually makes you laugh, that maybe, yeah, just brings something kind of lighthearted or playful to you. Is there a book like that for you, Anne-Marie?
There's definitely a book that I go back to for nourishment and sustenance. And if I am feeling low in mood, or if I need to be reawakened in some creative way, or just reminded of the gift of poetry, I always go back to Pharaoh's Daughter, published by the Gallery Press. And Pharaoh's Daughter features the selected poems of Nuala Nyonal in the Irish language, but the poems sit aside translations by 13 poems who are working in the English language. And that is such a wondrous book to me, because Nuala Nyonal is such a high priestess of poetry. I admire her hugely, and you know, I'm so grateful for her writing and folklore and around women's lives and drawing from place. But the translations are also they're so brilliant. Like, you know, they're really illuminating, and they're a feast of language. And I use that book in workshops a lot when I want to, you know, really excite people who are coming to poetry newly. And I draw that book down from my shelf, like I'm going to say nearly every 2 weeks, I'll take that down that book and I'll open. And I have gifted that book probably about 20, 30 times, because it's a book that you can give to someone who's a seasoned poetry reader. And it's also one that you can give to someone who has never read a poem off a page in their life. And it's a book that you can give to somebody who's maybe interested in the Irish language and they want to know, well, you know, what gets carried over from one language to another. But there's a particular poem in it, Yasa, in the Irish, and it has been translated by Maeve McGuckian as The Bond. And I'll just read maybe the first two stanzas of the translation. If I use my forbidden hand to raise a bridge across the river, all the work of the builders has been blown up by sunrise. A boat comes up the river by night with a woman standing in it, twin candles lit in her eyes and two oars in her hands. It's like a dream poem, you know, with a visitation by a ghost. And, you know, Nuala Nyonal's work always reminds me that the veil between this life and another is remarkably thin. And she's back and forth all the time. And you feel the dead and the ancestors and the ghosts and the fiery power of women in her work, you know. So that's one I go back to.
I got a little shiver with that one. What's it like for you whenever you, like you were talking about giving that book to someone who perhaps has never come to poetry? What's it like when someone kind of, I don't know, gets it, you know, or just like, how does that feel for you when maybe you've got someone in a workshop class or whatever, you're introducing them to it and you think, you can see them kind of, what does that feel like for you?
It's like opening a door to the other world. And it always makes me very excited when I hear that a poet has not read Irish language poetry before. It just, you know, I get butterflies and I think, wow, we're about to break new ground and you're about to open this kind of door to a world that, you know, you probably instinctively know is there, but you've never had a chance to enjoy. And watching people kind of cross that threshold and begin to read maybe Irish poetry in translation, or sit down, you know, with a dictionary and try to unpick the words in an Irish language poem. Like, that is, yeah, it's a brilliant feeling. It feels like you're giving a gift, and definitely Nuala's work feels like a gift as well.
Beautiful. Okay, very hard question for a poet. One of your own books, now published or unpublished, that you would save over everything else you've written, and you can choose one book.
That's a very tough question. I have three full collections, and I genuinely love them all equally. And of course, everyone says your books are like your family, and it's totally true. And your publishers are part of that family as well, and you love them all. So I was thinking about this question, and I was thinking, okay, I couldn't say that I love any book more than another, but what I do have a very special connection to the publication where my first published poem appeared.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I think I had maybe just done my MA in creative writing, or I was about to do, so my MPhil in creative writing, or I was about to do it, one or another. And I did that at the Oscar Wilde Centre in Trinity College. And I sent out a poem to this magazine, and the magazine was The Stinging Fly. And I got this email back, and I nearly fainted. I was so excited. And the poem appeared in issue 11. It was published in September 2009. And the poem was called The Scandal. And yeah, it was the first time that I'd seen a poem on a page. And I carried that issue of the magazine around with me, like, you know, like for a week or two. And I was showing everyone, I was showing my family, showing my friends, and you were nearly kind of like sniffing the cover and stroking the poem. And it just, it was very surreal to finally have a poem on a page, you know.
I didn't realize that that was your first. So your first published poem was in The Stinging Fly, and of course now you're poetry editor for The Stinging Fly. That's some circle.
I know, it's like the poem always knows more than you know. It always knows more, and I could never have imagined in a million years at that time that I would be reading and selecting the poetry for the magazine. Not in a million years, Ruth, I would have thought. That's a mad idea, you know. But I, like, since I've had a very, ever since that time, I've had a very special relationship with the magazine, and was a featured writer then before my first poetry book got published, and then eventually started working with the magazine. So, yeah, I would have to take, I'd have to say I'm very attached to that.
Okay, we're saving issue 11 of The Stinging Fly, 2009. Yeah. That is saved. And then the last question is what you would save from your house that isn't a person or a beloved animal, and not a book. So something else.
I would save the wedding dress of my godmother. She gave it to me a few years ago as a gift. She was going to bring it to a charity shop, and I just balked at the idea. This beautiful ivory lace, elegant high-necked, you know, garment that is never going to fit me in a million years. But I thought at the time, oh, I'll take the dress and I'll repurpose it into a kind of a funky skirt, and I'll dye it black and wear it with boots. But now that I have it and that it's hanging in my wardrobe, you know, I'm far too sentimental to dismantle it. And in some, I expect it to appear in poems. And there's something about that wedding that I remember as well. You know, I was a flower girl at the wedding at 5 years old. And I have a very special relationship with her as well. I don't think I'll take the dress apart, but it's become an object that is very inspiring to me and has got me thinking already about wedding ceremonies. And I disappeared down a rabbit hole reading about these ancient rituals in Ireland where by nobility, kings would marry the land. And not, you know, and I remember then a few years ago, the British artist Tracy Emin marrying a stone. And all of a sudden, none of this seems mad to me. In fact, it's very exciting to think that there are ceremonies in our culture to wed ourselves to places and to non-human kind of sources of energy. So the wedding dress remains, and it may appear in a poem sometime soon.
Wonderful. Now, you're going to read to us from your third collection, isn't it? It is your third collection, yes.
That's right, yeah.
And this is Hymn to All the Restless Girls, published by the Gallery Press. Do you want to tell our listeners just a little bit about it before you read for us, Anne-Marie?
Yeah, the book is it's a praise book, really, for the restless girls of Irish history. I suppose that we have this tradition in Ireland of the seeker or the searcher goes on a sacred journey from one world to another. And, you know, when I think of our oldest warriors or mythological heroes, and many of our poets are rarely at rest. And I think it's an interesting thing to think about that, you know, being in flow, being in motion, going on a journey, going on a quest is very much part of the Irish way of achieving, you know, a certain type of wisdom or growth or self-knowledge. And it's a little bit at odds with other traditions, maybe Eastern traditions, where stillness is the pose really for learning and self-discovery. That doesn't seem to me to be the way so much in Ireland. And started to think about the restless girls of Irish history who've been on a quest, you know, the girls like Sinead O'Connor or figures like Queen Maeve, you know, all of these women who kind of live in our imaginations and in our psyche and who are seekers and searchers. And then this kinship sprung up between the restless girls and the ravens, of course, who really helped me with this book. They made a lot possible, you know, and they kind of opened a lot of doors for me. Yeah. Hymn to All the Restless Girls. On this anniversary of the Irish state, better instead to celebrate a restless girl. A restless girl speaks the language of birch. A restless girl can besmirch a priest in a flash. A restless girl takes a splash of whiskey before noon. The skin of a restless girl smells of gunfire and wolves. Often a restless girl will ask, if not now, when. Many restless girls fall asleep in the sun. One restless girl had to be pinned down by six men. Another restless girl tore up an image of the Pope. A restless girl may disguise herself as a stone. Sometimes a pale horse will take a restless girl away in the night. The underslip of a restless girl should not be washed, it should be burned. When leaving a room, first check the corpse of a restless girl has not sprung alive behind your back. Best always to bury a restless girl in the wettest, darkest earth. They say that a restless girl once returned to haunt an innocent man. A whole town can be fouled by one restless girl. But see how the restless girl shimmers in the razor light of a Scots pine. See how she sweetens the air like hawthorn. The restless girl belongs to us as fox belongs to moon. The fact is, the restless girl has been for us a constitution. On public occasions, we wear a necklace from which the ornament of our cut tongue hangs. If the last restless girl ends up drowned or turned to ash or trapped inside a horsehaired wall, what then? what then?
You've been listening to the wonderful Anne-Marie Nicoron. Her latest collection, Hymn to All the Restless Girls, is out now with the Gallery Press. See you all next time.